Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Dan Friedel, Gregory Stockel, and Dan Novak. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present the first part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
NATO's 30 members have signed an agreement that permits Sweden and Finland to join the military alliance. The agreement was signed Tuesday during a NATO meeting in Brussels. The action came after NATO representatives meeting last week in Spain officially invited Sweden and Finland to join. The legislatures in all alliance nations must approve the agreement before Sweden and Finland can be fully admitted into NATO. That process is expected to take up to a year. Sweden and Finland, however, will be able to take part in NATO meetings and will be given greater access to NATO intelligence information. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called the signing truly a historic moment. He added, "With 32 nations around the table, we will be even stronger." The move further separates Russia from Europe after its invasion of neighboring Ukraine in February. Russia had repeatedly warned both countries against joining NATO. On March 12th, Russia's foreign ministry said if the move went forward, there will be serious military and political consequences. Stoltenberg urged lawmakers in allied countries to quickly approve or ratify the agreement. "The security of Finland and Sweden is important for our alliance, including during the ratification process," he said. Experts say getting parliamentary approval in Turkey could be problematic, although Sweden, Finland, and Turkey held talks on the matter last week in Spain. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has warned that Turkish legislators could block the process. The lawmakers are concerned about how Sweden and Finland will deal with Turkish demands to extradite people it considers terror suspects. Erdogan said this issue could lead Turkey's parliament to refuse to ratify the agreement. For the agreement to go into effect, all 30 member states must ratify it. Stoltenberg said he does not expect Turkey to reject the deal. "There were security concerns that needed to be addressed, and we did what we always do at NATO. We found common ground," he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Highland Park, Illinois, a quiet, wealthy, small city north of Chicago, is mourning at least six people who were killed by a gunman at a July 4th parade. The shooting wounded more than 30 others. People attending the parade first thought the gunshots were the sound of fireworks celebrating America's Independence Day. Hundreds of people of all ages then fled in terror as a gunman fired into the crowd from the top of a building. They left behind food, a baseball hat, lawn chairs, and baby carriers bearing American flags. Highland Park is known for its large, costly homes along Lake Michigan. About 30,000 people live there. Michael Jordan lived in Highland Park in the 1980s and 1990s when he played basketball for the Chicago Bulls. Barbara Hart, 73, lives in the city. She said she stayed away from the parade because she was worried about a shooting. She later came out of her home and told reporters, "There's no safe place." After several hours of searching, followed by a brief chase, police detained Robert E. Cremo III on Monday evening. At a Tuesday news conference, officials said the 21-year-old Cremo used a high-powered rifle similar to an AR-15 in the shooting. He fired 70 bullets into the crowd that had gathered for the parade. The suspect, they said, then dropped the weapon and fled to his mother's house. Officials said at the news conference that he had planned the attack for several weeks, but they did not immediately know the reason behind the attack. Cremo had a similar rifle in his mother's car when he was taken by police on Monday night. He had other weapons at his home, all of which were bought legally. Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering said she knew Cremo when he was a little boy. Cremo's father owned a small food business in Highland Park and once ran for mayor. What happened? How did somebody become this angry, this hateful? She asked. The Reuters news agency reported that social media posts that appeared to be linked to either Cremo or his musical act, Awake the Rapper, often showed violent images or messages. One music video posted to YouTube under Awake the Rapper, for example, showed drawings of a stick figure holding a rifle in front of another figure spread on the ground. On Monday, President Joe Biden said he and his wife, Jill, were shocked by the senseless gun violence that has yet again brought grief to an American community. The mass shooting on July 4th is the third in recent months. In May, a man shot and killed 10 people at a food store in Buffalo, New York. Later that month, a man shot and killed 21 students and teachers at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. It definitely hits a lot harder when it's not only your hometown, but it's also right in front of you, Ron Tuazone told the Associated Press. He and a friend returned to the streets Monday evening to collect chairs, blankets, and a child's bicycle that he and his family had left behind when the shooting began. "It's commonplace now," Tuazone said. "We don't blink anymore. Until laws change, it's going to be more of the same." I'm Dan Friedel.
Banned some single-use or disposable plastic products recently as part of a plan to slowly discontinue the use of the material in the South Asian nation. For its first step in the plan, the federal government has identified 19 plastic products that are not very useful but have a high possibility of becoming waste. It is illegal to produce, import, keep, give them out, or sell them. These products include cups, straws, and ice cream sticks made from plastic. Some disposable plastic bags will also be banned and replaced with thicker, reusable ones. Thousands of other plastic products, like bottles for water or bags for food, like chips, are not covered by the ban. But the federal government has set targets for manufacturers to be responsible for recycling or disposing of them after their use. Plastic manufacturers had appealed to the government to delay the ban. They said inflation and possible job losses are a concern. But India's federal environment minister, Bhupender Yadav, told the media at a meeting in New Delhi that the ban had been in progress for a year. "Now that time is up," he said. This is not the first time that India has considered a plastic ban. Previous bans have centered in some areas of the country with different degrees of success. A nationwide ban that includes not just the use of plastic, but also its production and importation, was a definite boost, said Satirupa Shikhar. A definite boost means a clear improvement. Shikhar is the Asian Pacific Area Advisor for the organization Break Free from Plastic. Most plastic is not recycled around the world. The materials pollute the world's oceans, affect wildlife, and turn up in drinking water. And scientists are still trying to understand the risks from very small pieces of plastic, known as microplastics. The country's waste management system cannot handle its growing cities and villages. It means that much of the waste is not recycled and ends up polluting the environment. Ravi Agarwal is the director of Toxic Link, a New Delhi-based group that supports waste management. Agarwal said the ban was a good beginning, but its success will depend on how well it is carried out. The actual enforcement of the law will be in the hands of individual states and cities. I'm Gregory Stockel.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last week that a prayer led by a high school football coach following games is constitutionally protected free speech. While some praised the decision as a win for religious freedom, others feared the decision could be harmful to non-Christian students. The court ruled 6-3 for the coach with the conservative justices in the majority, and the liberals in dissent. The case, Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, was the latest in a series of rulings in support of Christian plaintiffs. A plaintiff is a person who brings a legal action against another in a court of law. The case forced the justices to balance the religious and free speech rights of teachers and coaches with the rights of students not to feel pressured into joining in religious practices. The coach, named Joseph Kennedy, would lead a prayer in the middle of the field after football games. He was a coach at Bremerton High School in the northwestern state of Washington. the school asked him not to pray with players while still on duty as a coach after the games. But he continued to do so. The head coach later proposed not to bring back Kennedy. The liberal justices in the minority said there was evidence that the students felt pressured to join Kennedy's prayers. They argued the prayers permitted him to include his personal religious beliefs into a school event. But the justices in the majority pointed out that the coach's prayers came after the games were over. They said the prayers were at a time when Kennedy was not responsible for students and was free to do other things. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote for the majority in the ruling. He argued it would be wrong to treat everything public school teachers and coaches say and do as speech open to government control. If that were true, a school could fire a Muslim teacher for wearing a headscarf in the classroom or prohibit a Christian aide from praying quietly over her lunch in the cafeteria, he wrote. Dissenting Justice Sonia Sotomayor argued that this decision does a disservice to schools and the young citizens they serve, as well as to our nation's long-standing commitments to the separation of church and state. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects freedom of speech. It also bans Congress from making laws that establish a religion or prevent people from exercising their religion. Thomas Jefferson served as the country's third president. He wrote in an 1802 letter to a religious organization that the clause represents a wall of separation between church and state. The Bremerton School District said in a statement that the court's decision undermines the separation required by the Constitution. The school said that it had followed the law and acted to protect the religious freedom of all students and their families. The lawyer who represented Kennedy said it would permit the coach to finally return to the place he belongs, coaching football and quietly praying by himself after the game. 34 religious groups in the Bremerton, Washington area filed a friend of the court brief before last week's decision. The groups include Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, and several different Christian movements. They said Kennedy's actions pressured students into joining him in prayers. Jewish and Muslim groups warned that the decision could harm the religious rights of non-Christian students. The National Council for Jewish Women, or NJW, argued that the court's decision brought down the wall between religion and state. The group added, "The impact on people, especially children who practice a minority religion or no religion, cannot be overstated." Emma Melton works for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, a Muslim civil rights group. She said in a statement that the decision further alienates Muslim students who are already disproportionately impacted by bullying, harassment, and discrimination in school. Edward Ahmed Mitchell is a top official with CARE. He told Education Week that the decision needs to be enforced equally. "We know if a Muslim teacher does what this coach did, it could spark a very different reaction, but he or she has the right to do it now. Will this be equally applied to all people?" he asked. I'm Dan Novak.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about George Washington. He was the first president of the United States. He served from 1789 to 1797. But he had many other accomplishments, too. He owned thousands of hectares of land in his home state of Virginia. He was a famous general who led the American colonists to freedom from British rule, and he presided over the convention that created the U.S. Constitution. For Washington, that was enough. He said he wanted to retire from public service and return home. But the country's new electors had other ideas. They wanted him to move to New York and invent the American presidency. Washington accepted the job as his duty. Washington was sworn in as president in 1789. At the time, a truly United States was still just an idea. Americans were unconnected groups. They came from different countries, had different religions, and spoke different languages. For example, a quarter of the people in the state of Pennsylvania spoke only German. Doug Bradburn is the founding director of the Washington Library at Mount Vernon. He says, when Washington took office, the country was fragile.
The chances that it would even survive were probably very, very slim.
Bradburn explains that Washington had to establish social and political unity. But the Constitution did not say how the president could do that. So, Bradburn says, Washington invented the job for all future presidents. He established a group of advisors called the Cabinet, as well as the nation's official money. He appointed a 6-member Supreme Court, and he created the Department of Foreign Affairs, now called the State Department. However, Washington said it was the president's responsibility to set foreign policy. Historian Doug Bradburn explains that Washington established the president not just as a figurehead, but as a decision maker. But he always used the Constitution as his guide.
He wasn't just trying to establish an office and then figure out a way to justify it. He was trying to work with his Constitution.
George Washington was born in 1732 in the colony of Virginia. His father died when George was 11 years old. As a boy, he learned reading, writing, and math. Then he worked as a land surveyor in western Virginia. Historian Joseph Ellis points out that Washington did not have a formal education. Instead of going to college, Ellis says, Washington went to war. He fought against the French and Indians as a British army officer. That experience informed Washington's worldview. Ellis describes the first president as a realist. At the same time, Washington was a very passionate man with extremely strong emotions. He was known to get angry, but he showed his temper to only a few people. Washington not only acted like a great leader, he looked like one. George Washington stood about 1.9 meters tall. That was a head taller than the average man of his time. He was very strong and very graceful. He was known as one of the best horseback riders and best dancers in Virginia. But he had a problem: bad teeth. Unlike his wife, Martha, who was known for her lovely smile, George Washington began losing his teeth in his 20s. When he was sworn in as president, he had only one tooth left. Washington remains an important figure in the American imagination. Even today, people tell stories about him. One popular story, that he had wooden teeth, is not true. But he did wear dentures. They were made, in part, from hippopotamus ivory. And he did not chop down a cherry tree as a child, and then admit it by saying, "I cannot tell a lie." In fact, historian Joseph Ellis says, Washington lied many times. But it is true that as Washington became more famous, his reputation grew. People thought of him as a man who always did the right thing. Joseph Ellis says even Washington understood people would look at his writings and judge him.
Washington went from being a man to a monument. He was aware of the fact that he had a role to play and that all emerging nations need mythical heroes.
Washington became very protective of his personal thoughts. His wife burned most of their letters. Yet, we know a little bit about Washington's thoughts from other writing. One of his regrets, he said, was that he had not done something to end slavery. Like many plantation owners, Washington was a slaveholder. More than 300 enslaved people lived on his property. By the end of his life, Washington opposed slavery. He left a will ordering his survivors to free his slaves after his wife's death. Washington's will became relevant sooner than he might have liked. 3 years after he finished his second term as president, Washington fell ill. He had been outside riding his horse on a cold, wet day. When he came home, he complained of a sore throat. Over the next 2 days, his condition became worse. On December 14th, 1799, he died in his bed, surrounded by his wife, enslaved maids, and friends. He was 67. Historian Joseph Ellis says one of the best things about George Washington was his ability to give up power. At the end of the Revolutionary War, General Washington surrendered his sword. And at the end of his administration, President Washington simply returned home.
You could trust Washington with power because he was so conspicuously willing to give it up.
Doug Bradburn says Washington was the right man at the right time. Bradburn, like many historians, calls George Washington the indispensable man. In other words, Washington was essential to the American experiment in self-government. He made ideas about American freedom real, and he showed that even the president would operate under the rule of law. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.